We're ready for Isaiah 49 to 52. And if you, I think there's still some of the handouts. If you're missing that, raise your hand. If you want one, now, not everybody's using that. If you want one, raise your hand and they'll get that to you. I try to call attention to the information that's on there to help you fill that out as we go along. Isaiah 49 to 52 in our study tonight is where we are. We're in the second major section, which deals with the Babylonian period, where the first deals with the Assyrian period. And we have looked at deliverance from Babylonian captivity, though that's still hinted at in this next section that we're going to be talking about. We're ready for 49 to 57. We're only going to go through chapter 52, but this deals with the suffering servant. And if you have just a smattering knowledge of Old Testament terminology, you will recognize immediately, even if you have not read this section, that the suffering servant is a reference to the Messiah. And so this section speaks of the servant who is the Messiah, the Christ, the Son of God. That's what we're talking about. So here's a spoiler here for those of you who are trying to keep up with the Messianic sections on the back of the page at the bottom of your handout. We always list there, if there is a Messianic section, to list your Messianic passages. And so as we've been coming along, we'll make a section. We'll say these three verses are Messianic, or maybe these five verses are Messianic, or this verse is Messianic. And so here's the spoiler on this, and that is the Messianic section is all of it tonight. Chapters 49 to 53, and it goes on to 57. And so in this lesson, that is what the question is about, list the Messianic sections found in 49 to 52. It's 49 to 52. Now, that doesn't mean every single verse has reference to the Messiah. There'll be sections that will talk about Babylonian captivity, and we'll talk about that, deliverance from Babylonian captivity. And that'll be blended in with a prophecy of the Messiah. And we'll talk about all of that, but that would only be a few verses we might pull out of the entirety of that, but the whole section is Messianic. And that's going to continue through chapter 57, and then there's going to be some Messianic things in 58 to 66. So we're heavily Messianic now, looking for references to the Messiah. So this is the suffering servant. Three things we're going to talk about in our study tonight. The work of Jehovah's servant, that is the Messiah, that's chapter 49. What's his work? What is his mission? What is he accomplishing? We'll get to that here in just a moment. The second thing that is talked about is in chapters 50 and 51, we group those together, Israel is told to trust and follow the Lord. That was the very thing they had not done, and the thing that would lead to Babylonian captivity. Now, Babylonian captivity hasn't taken place yet. There's only prophecy of it, but we're already talking, and even before that time, about the deliverance from Babylonian captivity. And so he is the very thing that would lead to that captivity is the very thing they didn't do, and that is follow the Lord. Now, he's going to talk about the Messiah submitting to his Father. The very thing they did not do, the Messiah himself did, and that is he was obedient and was submissive. And then chapter 52, we see deliverance and a suffering servant. Deliverance from Babylonian captivity, still being hinted at, still being talked about, but blending in with the concept of deliverance through the Messiah. Now, there's two things we want to remind ourselves of that we've already covered that'll help us in this study. One is the nature of how the prophets have operated or will operate, and particularly Isaiah does this. And that is they paint a black, dark background of the sin of the nation, which he's done in previous chapters. And then out of that is growing a brighter future in the Messiah. We're ready for that brighter future. Though he's hinted at that, here's a bigger picture, a more perfect picture of the Messiah. So that's being done here. But also, there's the jumping back and forth as he talks about the present to the future. And we'll talk a little bit about how that's done a little bit later in chapter 49 and chapter 50 concerning this matter of talking about Babylonian deliverance from Babylonian captivity. And then without making a distinction, jumps right into the day of the Messiah. That's the nature of how the prophets operate. And we'll tell you why that's the case. I think there's a reason for that. It's not that they could have been written clearer, but there's a reason from the vantage point of the prophet, and we've talked about that previously. All right, let's talk about chapter 49 now, and this is the work of Jehovah's servant, the Messiah. So the first page of your handout is all about chapter 49. So we'll try to play to that and find the answers for that as we go along. Three things are going to happen in this. The servant is sent to all, Jew and Gentile, but all will not listen. Now, if we were to erase Old Testament references and say we were saying we're going to be talking about the gospel, we make these same three points from the gospels, you'd say, well, that well fits the gospels, and it does. And that is that the Messiah came to all men, but all men did not accept him. Secondly, there's the blessings under the Messiah. And thirdly, God hasn't forgotten his people. Well, that could well fit any one of the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John, or any epistle for that matter. So let's start with verses 1 to 6. The servant is sent to all, but all will not listen. So the Messiah is, the point of verses 1 to 6 is that the Messiah's message was sent to the Gentiles as well as to the Jews, but his own nation didn't receive him. And that reminds us, as noted in the workbook, that John 1, verses 11 and 12, he came unto his own, and his own did not receive him. So he begins at verse 1, listen, O coastlands, to me. We're focusing on verses 1 and 2, that is, all should listen to the servant, for he is Jehovah's spokesman. That's why we need to listen to him. So let's get verses 1 and 2. Listen, O coastlands, to me, and take heed, you people from afar. That would be the Gentiles. You're looking for that information. The Lord has called me from the womb. Speaking of the servant that we're going to see later in the context. From the matrix of my mother, he made mention of my name and has made my mouth like a sharp sword. That is, the word comes forth from the mouth of the servant. In the shadow of his hand, he has hidden me and has made me a polished shaft. That is, an arrow. We'll come to what that means here in just a second. In the quiver, he has hidden me. So even the people from afar, that is the Gentiles, are called to listen to him. But before he even entered the world, verses 1 and 2 suggest, before he became flesh and dwelt among men, John 1, verses 1 to 14, his mission was decided. And that is, his mouth speaks forth the word. That is, here's the message of the gospel or salvation being delivered. And the polished shaft may suggest something of judgment. So his mission is bringing salvation, but also bringing judgment. And so here is the Messiah being prophesied. If we didn't get any further, we know that all people are to listen to him, Jew and Gentile. Listen to the Messiah, for he is the spokesman of God, sending forth the word of God. Well, that reminds us of Hebrews 1, verses 1 and 2. God, in times past, spoke to the fathers by the prophets, hath in these last days spoken by his Son. So he indeed is the spokesman. Now let's catch verses 3 and 4. The point here is that many will reject him. Verse 4 would be kind of the key to that, but he mentions my servant, O Israel. Now you have a question about that. The servant is referred to as Israel. And I think Israel is not referring here to the nation, but it's referring to the Messiah, to the servant that's mentioned in the context. If you have the workbook, look at the footnote number 2, and I'll just simply read that in this verse. God refers to his servant, the Christ, as Israel. Jackson, that's Wayne Jackson, quotes John Martin saying, the Messiah is called Israel because he fulfills what Israel should have done. In his person and his work, he epitomizes the nation. The point is that Israel should have glorified God, but they failed. The Messiah is Jehovah's Israel because he's doing what they failed to do. Well, that's a good point. And I'll give Jackson credit for the wording of that. Not for the thought, because that came from God himself. But notice at verse 4, then I said, I have labored in vain. I have spent my strength for nothing in vain. What's the point? All men are invited, but it's as if it's in vain. It's not saying, because we're going to learn in chapter 55, the gospel is never in vain when it goes forth. But the point is that many rejected him, and the invitation to them was in vain because they didn't accept that. It's like the gospel, the grace being in vain, 2 Corinthians 6, Galatians 6, verses 1 and 2, and 2 Corinthians 6 as well. Verses 5 and 6, his mission now is twofold, and you're watching for this. And so let's see what the twofold mission is. At verse 5, now the Lord says, who formed me in the womb to be his servant, to bring Jacob back to him, that is Israel back to him, so that Israel may be gathered to him. So what's that about? That is bringing the Jews back. The Jews rejected him and bringing the Jews back. You'll notice that I make the point in the workbook that the premillennialists misuse that to talk about the return of the Jews back to Palestine. That's not what he's talking about. And you're looking on the second page of your handout, passages in this lesson that are quoted in the New Testament, and that should be quoted or alluded to. Not all of them are direct quotes. And here's the first. Verses 49, chapter 49 and verse 5 and 6 are referred to in Acts 13 and 47. And the point in Acts 13, 47, it's applied to spiritual matters in the day of the Messiah. He may have reference to them coming back or alluding to that here in this context, but really he's talking about under the day of the Messiah. And so here's the point. Look at to bring Jacob back. And he says at verse 6, indeed, he says, is it too small a thing to you that you should be my servant to raise up the tribe of Jacob to restore the preserved ones of Israel? But here's a second mission that he has, that I will give light to the Gentiles that you should be my salvation to the ends of the earth. So what's the twofold mission you're looking for in the handout? Well, the twofold mission is to restore Jacob and illuminate the Gentiles, to bring salvation to the Jews, bring salvation to the Gentiles. Well, repeatedly the New Testament talks about to the Jew first and also to the Greek, parallel phrase. That's the kind of thing we're talking about. Now, let's jump down to verses 1 to 6. The servant is sent to all. I want to get the broader picture here and not worry about every detail, but the servant, the Messiah, is sent to Jews and Gentiles. But all didn't listen. Some are going to reject him, especially his own people. Obviously, many Gentiles will, but many of his own people did. His mission was to the Jew and to the Gentile. So I learned something of his mission. Now, verses 7 to 13, let's talk about blessings under the Messiah. The blessings that are available under the Messiah. What is this all about? Well, look at verse 7. He will be rejected, and he will those that reject him will ultimately acknowledge indeed who he is. That the Redeemer of Israel, verse 7, to him man despises, and to him whom the nation abhors. He's going to be despised and abhorred. The servant and the rulers, the kings shall see and arise. Princes shall also worship. Because of the Lord who is faithful. In other words, he's saying in that, simply that the time will come, those who have ignored him and abhorred him are going to recognize that indeed he is the chosen one of God. It may be too late, but they're going to recognize him. So the point is that though he was rejected by men, we're going to see more about that in the 53rd chapter, he ultimately is going to be acknowledged for who he is. It may be ultimately too late. Let's look at verses 8 to 12. I'm going to leave this outline. We're going to come back to that. You're looking for these 9 points in your handout. But notice the blessings under the Messiah. And so rather than worry about every detail of this, I think it's safe to say that every one of these are things that are descriptions of salvation. That is his mission. That he's going to Jew and Gentile, and this is what he's bringing. So let's get the picture. This also, and I know we're jumping around a little bit, but on your second page of your handout, the passages that are quoted or alluded to in the New Testament, here's a second one. Chapter 49 and verse 8 is alluded to in 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 2. Now is accepted time, day is the day of salvation. And that's how that's quoted or alluded to there. It is an acceptable time that you have heard the day of salvation, I have helped you. And here's how Paul uses that in 2 Corinthians 2, that salvation is now available. We quote that frequently and tell him, you need to obey the gospel today and not wait till tomorrow, because now is accepted time. Today is the day of salvation. That's true. That's not what that text is saying. The text is saying it's available now, where it wasn't always available to you. Salvation, this is the period of salvation. So in the period of salvation, this is what God's going to do. So let's start at verse 8, start listing these. Here's the first, that he will he will restore the earth to the people. That I'll preserve you and give you as a covenant of the people and restore the earth to cause them to inherit the desolate heritage. So what's that talking about? Well, it's not talking about some premillennial or millennialist or dispensational concept, as some may abuse that, but he's talking about simply descriptions of salvation. It's described as inheriting the earth, perhaps parallel to a phrase used in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5. Psalms use the expression inheriting the earth, enjoying it to the fullest. So when you receive salvation, you are enjoying salvation and the blessings of God in the earth to the fullest. Verse 8, another phrase that's used is he'll give them an inheritance. They will inherit the desolate heritage, and so they will have an inheritance. Verse 9, he'll set prisoners free, release from sin. He's going to feed the hungry, verses 9 and 10. The hunger will never thirst. There will be those who will be protected from heat and the sun, not literally, because those who have salvation still face heat and they're still under the sun. But as you can imagine, in recent days of being out in the scorching sun, and if you just had some shelter, well, salvation is pictured as sheltering from the sun or from the heat. Verse 10, he'll lead them to the springs of water. He'll make each mountain a road. In other words, here's something difficult, and you say, that's not even a road, that's a mountain. God will make that mountain a road. That's a picture, again, of salvation. And he'll elevate the highways, the low highways. He'll raise up, bring the mountains low and the highways up. God's making a way to salvation. And then verse 12, people from all nations will come and partake in the blessing. So here again is a reference to the Gentile. Surely they shall come from afar. You might make a margin note, Gentiles. Now let's stop and footnote here. And that is when the New Testament time came and some of the Jews act shocked that God's going to open the door for the Gentiles. They weren't very familiar with Old Testament terminology. Because you say, well, the Gentiles were not spelled out by name. Oh, yes, they were. Amos 9 called them by name. The Gentiles would come in. So they were ignoring these kinds of references. So those are the blessings that are found in the Messiah. 9 things found here you're looking for. These are blessings in the Messiah. Now, do you think the prophet fully understood everything he spoke of? Peter tells us they didn't. But we do. We understand that because we're living in the day of the Messiah. Now let's go back, and here's where we are. We're right here ready for verse 13. The result of these blessings, and here's something very practical. The result of these blessings is rejoicing. Sing, O heaven, and be joyful, O earth, and break out in singing, O mountains. Here's the practical thing. Sometimes we are in the kingdom. We think we have experienced salvation. We would claim to be children of God, have the hope of heaven, and yet we can act like we're the saddest, most pitiful people on the face of the earth. And we drag like we've lost our last friend. And yet, the prophet said, those who experience those blessings we just listed, or go forth with singing and with shouting, and there's excitement and there's rejoicing. Well, that's us. At least that's supposed to be us, according to verse 13. Now, let's start at verse 14. God has not forgotten them. So let's look at verse 14 now. And we're looking for, verse 14, a charge that Zion has made. That is, the people of God has made. Here's the charge or the accusation. The Lord has forgotten me, and my Lord has forgotten me. Probably a reference to their feeling while they're off in Babylonian captivity. That they're off, and though they'd listened to the prophets had said you'll be there for 70 years, and so once they're there for 50 years, they know we've got 20 more years to go. We're not ready for release. But be that as it may, while they're off in captivity, they may reach the point, and did reach the point, God's forgotten about us over here. And so the accusation or the charge is God has forgotten his people. Now there are 3 responses that are given to that, and so watch for these 3 things right here in this context. Now, I want to stop just for a moment before I do that and say that he's talking about Babylonian captivity, I'm convinced, and the release from captivity. God's going to bring you out of captivity. But he blends that in with the release coming through the Messiah. Now, let's pause for a moment. We're going to come back to this context. And here's something you've seen in previous studies before. what I call the prophet's view. I credit John Humphreys, if you have his commentary on Jeremiah, is where he presents this, but I heard him present this in person nearly 40 years ago. And he talks about this a little in his commentary on Isaiah. But from the prophet's vantage point, so forget about Isaiah for a moment and picture this person, forget about him being a prophet. He's looking at two mountain ranges. Here's a mountain range and a mountain range. And as he views across that, they all blend together. He can't see much distinction in one mountain range and the other, and where one stops and the other one starts. But from our vantage point, we're looking at those mountain ranges from another vantage point, and there's a distance between those mountains. But he's from his vantage point, it looks like those mountains blend together. So often the prophet talks about a release from Babylon and salvation through the Messiah and just blends it all together. But we have the advantage of New Testament interpretation where we can distinguish that. Does that make sense? And so I think he does that right here. So when I come across a passage like this, I draw a little diagram like this, as John suggested a number of years ago, as I was a young student of 20 years old in his class, draw out to the side a little drawing reminding me this is where the prophet is viewing two mountain ranges, so to speak, and they just blend together in his view. All right, with that in mind, let's go back now to the context in chapter 49. Has God forgotten his people? And the answer is no, God hasn't forgotten them. And he views that first mountain range, there's going to be a release from Babylon, but he blends that in with the day of the Messiah because that's the context. So let's see the three answers that God gave. He said, I will remember you as a mother does her child. Let's get 15 to 18. We're not going to read every word of this, but look at verse 15. That's kind of a key to that section. Can a woman forget a nursing child and not have compassion on the son of her womb? I cannot forget you any more than a mother would her child. I haven't forgotten you. Now look at verse 17. Your sons shall make haste. Your destroyers and those who laid waste shall go away from you. Now he's talking about Babylonian captivity. I hadn't forgotten about you. Babylon, who is your destroyer, is going to go away. I'm going to take care of them. Babylon's going to fall. He's already told them that. Lift up your eyes and look around. Verse 18. And all these together and come to you as I live, says the Lord. Surely you shall clothe yourselves with them as with an ornament and bind them as a bride does. Now, what on earth is all of that about? Well, the returning to their homeland is pictured of adorning Zion like a bride that's dressed for her wedding day. That's the point of verse 18. So have I forgotten you? No, I haven't forgotten you. No more than a mother would her child. You're going to go from Babylon. I'm going to take care of Babylon. They're going to fall. They're going away. And I'm going to dress you like a bride going back to her wedding. I'm gonna adorn you. I will remember you. Now, verses 19 to 23. I will bless you with children and inhabitants. In other words, you're going to go back to your homeland, and I'm going to bless you with children and inhabitants. In fact, here's evidence of that. Look at verse 19. They will finally reach to the point that they say it's too small for the inhabitants. Verse 20. The children you will have after you have lost the others will say again in your ears, this place is too small. In other words, you're going to go back into the land and you're going to multiply and you're going to grow and it's going to be too small for you. In other words, I'm going to bless you with children and I'm going to bless you with inhabitants. Now let's drop down to verse 22, that same point. Thus says the Lord, behold, I will lift my hand and an oath to the nations, here's the Gentiles, and he said, and bring your sons in, your arms and your daughters that carried on your shoulders. So this would be offered to the Gentiles. Again, blending the Messianic period in with that. Now let's start at verse 24 and finish that chapter. He raises the question, can the prey be taken from the mighty? Can the prey be taken from the mighty? Look at verse 24. Shall the prey be taken from the mighty? And in other words, Israel, Judah, is the prey. And can they be can someone take them away from me? Can Babylon take them away from me? No, they can't. The answer is, they cannot do that. Here's what the Lord says, verse 25. Even the captives of the mighty shall be taken away, and the prey of the terrible will be delivered. I'm going to deliver you. And what's he going to do with the oppressor? I will feed them with their own flesh. How's this going to be done? Look at the end of verse 26. With the mighty one of Jacob. In other words, by God's strong right hand and his strength, this is accomplished. All right, I know that took a little time to work through 49. Then we got to pick up the pace for 50 and 51 and 52. They're a little shorter. But here's three things that we saw. The servant is sent to all, but they all wouldn't listen. Here's the blessings that are available under the Messiah. Has God forgotten his people? No, he hadn't forgotten his people. He hadn't forgotten at all. He's going to bring them out of the Babylonian captivity, and he has to have a nation through whom the Messiah is going to come. All right, let's move on. Let's go to chapter 50 and 51. I grouped those two together, 50 and 51. And in these two chapters, I call it simply, Israel is told to trust and to follow the Lord. Chapter 50, trust in the Lord who is faithful. Chapter 51, the exhortation to listen to God. All right, so put your trust in God and listen to God. Trust, chapter 51, listen, chapter 50, and then chapter 51. All right, let's look at chapter 50 now. In chapter 50, his point is to trust in the Lord. Look at verses 1 to 3. In light of the charge that was made in the previous chapter, in light of that, the question is raised here, what reason did Israel have to even question God? And so he asked the question, where is the certificate of divorce? And to which creditor have I sold you? In other words, what gave you a reason to question me and think I forgot about you? Did I divorce you? No. Did I sell you? No, I didn't do that. In fact, for your iniquities, you have sold yourself. There's your contrast you're looking for. God did not sell them. They sold themselves. There's your contrast. Verse 1. He says at verse 2, as he's developing, what reason did you have to question me? I've got every reason to question you. Because I called and no one answered. You could build a sermon around that. When I called, there was no one to answer. God's calling you through the gospel. God's calling you with every message that is delivered. I called, but I didn't get an answer. I was waiting for a response and I didn't hear anything. Why did you question me? He's asking. Now, did they think that God was too weak? Is it that my hand is shortened? Or that I don't have power? I'm paraphrasing. Do you not remember what I did to the sea and to, in other words, what I did in Egypt? Do you not remember what I did in Egypt and the power that I had? Did you think I didn't have the power? Well, I mean, what was in your thinking? Why did you question me? Now look at verses 4 to 9. This is a little more difficult for me. And if you get a little lost in this, then line up behind me because I get a little lost right here myself. The sense in which he will help his servant. I think we can explain that, but let's see if we can make some sense. Now the prophet, I think he was talking about in verses 1 to 3, the present day, that is the day of Isaiah. Now he turns to the day of the Messiah, as he often does, shift back and forth. That God's going to speak through his servant. I lost my verse here. Yeah, verse 4. That God's going to speak through his servant at verse 4. And unlike Israel that had faced captivity because they didn't listen, the servant listens. And notice at verse 5, the Lord had opened his ear and I was not rebellious. That is, the servant was not rebellious. I said earlier, there's part of that contrast. Now notice, let's drop down to verse 8. Let's look at verse 7. For the Lord God will help me, therefore I will not be disgraced. In what sense has the Lord helped him? The Lord will help his servant. The sense in which the Lord helps his servant, the servant is obedient, that is the servant, the Messiah, is obedient to the Father. He submits to the Father. But he is near who justifies me. This is the servant speaking. Your one translation will say that he vindicate. English Standard says he vindicates me. And so the Father will vindicate his servant. How so? Well, that's probably a reference to the resurrection from the dead. And that may be the sense in which he helps his servant. So the Father, the Lord, is going to help the servant, the Messiah, and he vindicates him. And do I know 100% that is a reference to the resurrection? No, but it makes good sense. Jackson, in his work, suggests that he thinks it may refer to that. And I'll leave it at that as well, that it may refer to him being vindicated in the sense of him being raised from the dead. Now notice at verse 9, and I'm going to paraphrase verse 9 without reading it. You can read the verse yourself. That those who oppose the Messiah are going to be unsuccessful. I think that's the point that he's making in verse 9. That may be another sense in which he helps his servant. Now here's a call to obey the servant, verses 10 and 11. You need to be obedient to the servant. You're watching for this at verse 10. Who among you fears the Lord who obeys the voice of the servant? Do you see the connection between fearing God and obedience to him? Deuteronomy makes that connection greater than any other work. So verses 10 and 11 is a call for people, to all people, to listen to the Messiah. This is the Messiah. So trust in the Lord who's faithful. What reason did you have to even question me? And then he turns to the day of the Messiah. The Lord will help his servant. And so what you need to do is listen and obey that servant who is indeed the Messiah. Now that gets us through chapter 50. Now, let's go on to 51. Let's go to 51. Here's the exhortation to listen in chapter 51. There are three reasons in verses 1 to 8 given why people need to listen to the Messiah. You're watching for this in your handout. Here's three reasons that are given for obeying God and ultimately the servant of God who is the Messiah. What are they? Now notice three times, you might underline this. Let's jump ahead. Verse 1, three times you find this phrase, listen to me. Verse 1, listen to me. Verse 4, you might underline, listen to me. And verse 7 starts with, listen to me. And so here's what I'm wanting to connect that to. Trust in the Lord. And then 51, listen to the Lord. Three times, listen to me, listen to me, listen to me. Ultimately, listen to the Messiah. Now, verses 1 to 3, here's the first of the three reasons. Because you're Abraham's seed. Because you are Abraham's seed, and thus you will be blessed. Let's look to Abraham. I'm at verse 2. Your father and to Sarah who bore you, for I called him alone and blessed him. For the Lord will comfort Zion, and he will comfort all her waste, and he will make her wilderness like Eden. You might underline, her wilderness like Eden. So since Israel was from the seed of Abraham, the one through whom the promise was given, they are assured they're going to be blessed. So that's why you need to listen to him. That's reason number one. The blessing would be he would turn their wilderness to Eden. That's a picture of salvation. Not only would that be true in the sense of their release from Babylon, but more so under the Messiah. That I'll take what was a wilderness and turn it into the Garden of Eden for you. Picture of salvation. That's why you need to listen to God. Now verses 4 to 6, because the law is going forth from the servant. Listen to me, my people, and give ear, for the law will proceed from me. That reminds me of Isaiah 2. The law will go forth from Jerusalem. The law will proceed from me, verse 4. Verse 5, my righteousness is near, my salvation has gone forth. That tells me the law that's going forth is the message indeed of salvation, and it's also available for Jews, not only Jews, but also for Gentiles. We see that. Now, notice at verse 6, before he gets through, notice the contrast. The earth will grow old, I'm at the middle of verse 6, like a garment. And so the earth, which has to do with how the world is wearing down. What is that? Second law of thermodynamics, I believe that's what that's called. The earth is wearing down. I'm not going to get into how that applies to refutes evolution, that is an interesting point, but he says the world is wearing down like a garment wearing out. The contrast here is to the word or the salvation that is forever. That is everlasting salvation in contrast to the world wearing out. The world around us is wearing down. Salvation lasts forever. That's the contrast. You're looking for that in your handout. So why listen? Because the law goes forth, and the third reason, your enemies will be destroyed, verses 7 and 8. Listen to me, he says. Here's the third time he says that. You people in whose heart is my law. Notice, do not be afraid. Do not fear men. Do not fear the reproach of men. For the moth will eat them up like a garment, and the worm will eat them like wool. In other words, they're going to be destroyed. They're going to be consumed. So your enemy will be defeated and be destroyed. Well, I think he's talking about, partially, the idea of their deliverance from Babylon, but blends that in with the day of the Messiah, because those three things would apply to the day of the Messiah. The law is going forth, you're the seed of Abraham, and your enemy will be destroyed. Now, let's get 9 to 16 now, and the call upon God to defend his people. Now, starting at verse 9, awake and put on strength. By the way, the call to God to defend his people is in verses 9 through 11. His response is in verses 12 to 16. So let's see what the call was. The call was requesting God to awaken his strength as he did in ancient days, referring to the deliverance from Egypt, and that he would defend his people. And the reference to Egypt is found in verse 9. The Rahab is a reference to Egypt, Psalm 87, and in verse, I believe it's verse 2 or verse 4. Now, beginning at verse 12, here was God's answer to that. God's answer basically is, this should never have been questioned in the first place. Just like we saw a little bit earlier. I, who comfort you, and verse 12, of a man that will die, and of the son of man who made like grass, and you forget the Lord your maker. In other words, you are the one that forgets your God. I haven't forgotten you. That should not be questioned in the first place. Look at verse 16. Yeah, verse 16. His point is God is in control of all. That I put my words in your mouth, and I've covered you with the shadow of my hand, that I may plant the heavens and lay the foundations of the earth. That's a description of God being in control of the earth. And so since I'm in control of all, then the question of whether I will defend you should never be questioned in the first place. So finally, he ends that section. I'm trying to get to chapter 52. He ends that section with a call to Jerusalem to listen, which is the whole point of the first part. Look at verse 22. Well, let's go back to verse 17. Awake, awake, stand up, O Jerusalem. They'd asked God to awake, verse 9. He tells them, you're the one that needs to awake. You have drunk of the hand of my fury. In other words, you have suffered punishment at my hand. I allowed Babylon to come, and only God can help, verse 18. Now notice it, verse 21. Therefore, please hear this, you afflicted, and drunk not with wine. Thus says the Lord, verse 22, the Lord your God, who pleads the cause of the people, surely I have taken out of your hand the cup of trembling. Now verse 23, and I will put it in the hand of those who afflict you. In other words, listen to me, I take away your burden and I give it to someone else. And so here's a call for Jerusalem to listen. So I know that's a hurried look, but I want to get to chapter 52 and see what we can do with that quickly. Trust in the Lord, chapter 50, exhortation to listen, chapter 51. Now, chapter 52 deals with two things. There's the deliverance from captivity, verses 1 to 12, and then there's the suffering servant. The latter section goes greater with chapter 53 than it does chapter 52, and you'll see why here in just a moment. So let's look at the first part of this, and that is the deliverance from Babylonian captivity. Deliverance from bondage, verses 1 to 12. Notice he says, first of all, verses 1 and 2, Zion is instructed to put on beautiful garments. Verse 1, O Jerusalem, for the uncircumcised and the unclean, for Babylon, and shake yourself of the dust and sit down, O Jerusalem. Loose your garments and your bonds from your neck, O captive daughter. In other words, you're being released. Put on beautiful garments. You're not wearing captive garments anymore. You're going forth from Babylonian captivity. It's a promise of release. Now, at verse 3, the Lord will redeem Zion. And so I think he's talking again about release from Babylon, but blends that in with the day of the Messiah. You sold yourselves for nothing, and you will be redeemed without money. In other words, the Lord's going to redeem Zion. And just like he did, he's going to deal with them like he did with Egypt and with Assyria. In other words, why did God allow Egypt to take them? Why did God allow Assyria to take them? And why is now God going to allow Babylon to take them? Verse 6 saying, because I have spoken. In other words, because God allowed it. That Egypt was a tool, Assyria was a tool, Babylon is a tool. That's why you went into captivity in the first place. So the Lord's going to redeem. Now the message of deliverance, verses 7 to 12, is going forth. And here's the third of the messages on your second page, a passage is alluded to in the New Testament. How beautiful are the feet of those who bring good news and peace and good tidings. That's quoted in Romans chapter 10, applied to the spread of the gospel. But here, the good tidings of good news, the peace, is Zion's deliverance, coupled with the Babylonian release from Babylonian captivity, again, seems to be blended into the day of the Messiah. And I know that's how it's applied in Romans chapter 10. That's when the good news and the great tidings and the gospel goes forth of the release from sin. Now, notice at verse 10, before we get the very last section and our time is about gone, the Lord made bare his arms. And that is, he revealed his power. That's what that means. God revealed his power. He made bare his arms. In other words, it's like God has a strong, he doesn't have physical arms, but he has a strong arm, and it's like God uncovered it to show his strength and show his bare arms. And so he did in the release from captivity. Now, notice this at verse 11, while he's still talking about captivity. Depart, depart, go out from her, touch no unclean thing. In other words, go forth from Babylon, but don't take Babylon with you. That's very practical. Leave Babylon. You were in captivity, but don't take Babylon with you. Here's the practical thing. God tells you to leave the world, but don't take the world with you. Don't take elements of the world with you. Don't take some of the Babylon practices back to Jerusalem. They did, but they were told not to. Now, the last section, the suffering servant, is all about the Messiah. And so in contrast, now he talks about three things concerning the servant. The first is he will be exalted, verse 13. That my servant will deal prudently and he will be exalted. Well, that's quite obvious how and that would be done. Verse 14, we're going to see more about this in chapter 53, but he's going to be treated shamefully. Many will be astonished at his visage, that is, his appearance was marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men. And so he's going to be abused, physically abused, to the physical destruction. And then thirdly, he will startle the nations. That's a difficult phrase. It says he will sprinkle the nations, and your translation may say he will startle the nations. I refer you to the quotation in the workbook from Homer Haley. I gave a lengthy quotation. See, there are two possibilities. We're going to end on this note. What does that mean? The commentators are about divided 50-50. Some think it means sprinkle the nations in the sense like the term was used of sprinkling water, sprinkling blood, etc. And they believe that the prophet has in mind the cleansing of the nations. He will cleanse the nations with the Messiah. Well, maybe so. But Haley thinks, along with Dalich and Leupold and Rawlinson and Smith and others, that he will astonish the nations. And in that sense, that he will startle them. They'll be astonished. And that seems to fit the context for the next thing he says, the kings will shut their mouths, verse 15, for what they have not seen, what they've not been told, and what they shall see. In other words, they're going to be astonished. They're going to be startled. And they're going to keep silent because they have not understood fully what they're going to see and what's going to happen with the Messiah. They utterly kill him and destroy him, and then he's raised from the dead. That probably the latter may be the case, though you may think it means to sprinkle. So that's a look at the Messiah, the servant. And we're going to continue the servant with a more familiar text, chapter 53. You're more familiar with it. We'll get into chapter 54 and 55 and 56 next time.